So let's continue with a few more features of object-oriented systems. So for example, we so far had only the situations that we had just one parent class to our subclass. What if you up the game and allow for more than just one parent? So there's lots of examples in the literature for that, where it makes sense. Whether it really makes sense, that's up to the user, the programmer, or even you. But the general idea would be that you would like to reuse code and data like this, these fields from parents in some way. And yeah, what would be the idea to realize that or to implement that in the intermediate representation? For an intermediate representation, we somehow need to integrate that into one representation or a chain of representations. And well, the thing that would be pretty obvious is to just join them in one representation in some meaningful way. And the idea for that would be, in this case at least, would be that you take your different parents, like for example the blue one and the green one, and arrange them just in a sequence, one after each other, so that afterwards it will look like in the representation that the first parent, what first is probably defined in just the class specification, comes first, then there's the second parent's representation, and then you continue with the child's representation. So the only thing that's different from single inheritance is in that case the green parts. So this is something new and shiny, and same as this part here is new. Everything else is just as you would expect it to be. And all the other design choices that we had so far integrate with that principle. So if you have other parents to, for example, this one here, then you would conceptually integrate them into the representation for the first parent. So the others are to be found over here. And if, for example, the green one also has other parents, like here, and it's inheriting from them, then also you would find them as the second component, so you would arrange them in there. Well, unluckily I chose red here, but that's the one corresponding to the other parents over there. So yeah, I think you get what I mean. Okay, so that is kind of the building blocks for the representation. The crucial point to that is that you have to come up with some kind of linear representation of a tree somehow, and that's how it's done in this case. So this is the representation for the simple layout that we had originally on the last slide. So we start with the representation for A, then we have the second parent B over there, and finally we have C, which is the child of both of them. So now, what does that mean? Does it make a difference in handling somehow? Well, for once, we now have in the data definition two references than one, so that's almost negligible. So that's nothing really exciting there. The thing that is more intriguing, I would say, is now situations like these, where you emanate from an object of a composed class like this C, which is inheriting from two parents, and then you want to make use of the polymorphic properties of the system and refer to this class with one of its parents types, and especially choosing the type that is that can be found in the middle as the type for the variable receiving the class is the interesting part. And why is that? Well, in case that you cast your object down to your, in this case, second parent, doesn't matter which parent it is in principle, as long as it is one of as long as it's the one which is not the one in front. So this one, in this case, is not the interesting one. And why is that? Because if you now start to call functions that are defined for that B, and that would be, in this case, no, each time, which would be the G in this case. Remember when we talked about our conventions that we had? The implementation of the method body of G, as soon as it wants to access the field B, it would expect it to be found. Why would it be expected to be found? Well, if we just look at the class B locally, then we have to completely ignore this one and this one. And the layout for just the an object of class B would be pretty simple, and we can find it over here. And it just consists of one field. So it would say the implementation for G can safely assume that it can find the field B at offset zero of the object that it belongs to. Well, so far, if you just look at the whole thing locally, that's fine. But now that we find ourselves in multiple inheritance environment where this B is in the middle of such a composed class, beginning of the memory space that we reserved for C is now pointing to the beginning of this one here. And that is now the representation for the whole thing. And since we had to compose the whole thing out of several of those, we cannot really make sure that B will be found at the, or B's offset for small b can be found at the offset zero, as it would have been expected. So the thing that that is different now than before is that as soon as we have explicit or implicit casts somehow in our code, like in this position where we want to cast to B and then start using B's B's fields, we need to make sure that the pointer that we are talking about is also somehow modified to not point to here, but instead to point to here. Oh, I want to start that. And yeah, for that we need to provide code. So casting when we do casting on objects that stem from multiple inheritance is now not a void operation, but now needs actual code to be performed, and that's reflected also in the translated code. So here we find first of all just the initialization of the whole thing, which consists of at first the new operator, which is, or the new function in this case, which is just a kind of special malloc, and the second component then is, well, in our case, it's just some initialization code. I think it should probably just write zero everywhere or copy some it's probably copying some memory image, but that's not so important for our purposes here. What's more important is that for the next thing, we want to perform this assignment where we have an implicit cast going on. And for that, what we see is, first of all, there's a address manipulation going on there with a get element pointer. It's manipulating by four times the data size of an integer of 8 bits, so it's manipulating by 32 bits, which is just the space that we need to represent the 32-bit integer from class A. So this will move our pointer just by the size of our object representation for A, so that in the end the pointer will point to the class B inside our class representation. So this is performing the adjustment from this to this. So that is what's done with this get element pointer, and after that we need to adjust the type of the whole thing. Well, the compiler seems to have done already a few special things here. So it didn't start off with generating a thing that had already the type for class C, but instead it already optimized the whole thing by allocating 8-bit integer-based thing with the according size, which would in this case be 12 for 3 times 32-bit integers, and then did the address computation on that. But in principle, the thing would be, it had to be add a constant to the object pointer, which has to correspond to the actual size of the second parent, the first parent, which would correspond to the offset of the second parent in the whole data structure, and that is exactly the size of the things that come before, and that's the size of the object representation of A. Yes, please?
If you allow your object to be accessed as a type A, because it is still a type A, because it's base type C, and C is as a parent A,
yeah.
Do you have to pass strokes to C to know that there is an A, root of A? Or is it smart enough to realize that B and A occur simultaneously here because it's a subclass?
If I understood you right, you now want to take the reference or this pointer B and cast it back, well, in some steps in between to the to A.
What steps do you need to take to go from B to A if you know that they both exist because C is your subtype?
Well, you have to communicate that to C++ somehow, and I think you have to go through through the context. So you have to cast to C before you can go to A.
So it wouldn't know that it's simultaneously being type A because it's a class of C.
Exactly. So and because as soon as you just start to act on the pointer B here, the type system doesn't have something that corresponds to B in the context of A, at least not on the high level language. If you have a look in the compiled intermediate languages, there's actually differences even in the object layouts if you or in the virtual tables if you reason about B in the context of A or just B alone. But there's something to that later on. Okay. Good. So that's something that changes from before. For casts, you now have to actually do something. And even if you don't have any casts involved in a direct way, well, in case that you, for example, start off from a object C and then call a method that is defined inside of B, well, I'm missing a few of the using clauses here, but it's just a kind of a conceptual class definition over here. You do the allocation on the bitcast. Well, that's just what you know. The bitcast is not what you ordinarily do. At first, you just do the memory allocation, and then you would like to call the G. But as G once again expects that the first parameter that is later on acting as this is once again of type B and starts addressing its fields from zero, and the thing that you have created is something which has stored its B-based components not from the start but from the middle somewhere, you still need to perform some actions, like you see here. You need to perform this pointer adjustment with a, in this case, first you, the compiler casts to 8-bit integer, and then just adjusts by 4 times 8-bit integer. Well, that seems to be something the compiler in this case really liked to do. But in principle, what it does is it it does the same pointer adjustment than before. So that must have been something that's better to implement or whatnot. I don't know. Anyway, later on, the resulting handle gets stored in there and then used as a pointer to class B in the static call to G. And yeah, then the whole thing is followed by some kind of parameter over here, and that's just the ordinary parameter. Yes, please.
If your system doesn't care about the typing at the point of column G because it's just using the pointer which has type I8 pointer, why is it still going to be after the first casting?
Why is it still? Sorry.
It's saying it's class B and giving an audit offset. Why doesn't it just say with the first pointer to C, I'm calling class B and give an offset of 42 and then...
Well, the get element pointer would have to have an offset of 1. I frankly don't know why it chooses to do it this way. It's... if you change the optimization level to something different, it will do something different. And it's not even guaranteed that each version will behave the same. So if you use the Clang in next major release, it might do something completely differently. So it's some decision of the developer. I haven't really found... There's also a lot of peephole optimizations going on in compilers, and it might be that that is something more sensible to do. I don't actually know. Yes, please.
Why is G statically
known here in this context in the last line? For C++, as long as I don't use any keyword like virtual, then it's just static method called. Well, I've omitted a few things here, like this using thing, but in principle, yeah, it's like that. Okay, good. So far, so good. Still, if I do inherit from several parents, there's this famous thing of this diamond property. Well, you have seen, you haven't seen the diamond so far, but later on. But anyway, in this case, you have seen that you can have two parents, and these two parents might each for themselves declare something similar or kind of something with the same signature, like in this case. So you have two class definitions, one A and B, and both of them decide to offer a method signature F with just an int as parameter. These are the cases that are a little bit problematic for our multiple inheritance structure because, well, as soon as you start to inherit from both of them, where both of them individually were quite fine, as soon as you start to inherit from both of them, as soon as you actually try to call one of these, the system wonders what did you actually want to achieve with that? Did you mean the to call the definition from A or the definition from B? And there are several possibilities which you can do there as a language designer. The first solution is the one that is actually found in C++, which would mean that as soon as you mention the ambiguities at some point, you will be warned, or even you earn a compiler error at that point, and it says that there's an ambiguity and you have to resolve that somehow. So the way to resolve that would be to explicitly qualify what you actually mean by that, with all the drawbacks that you get by that, like fixing your class hierarchy at points where you actually want to use your things, or you have to that inserts some dependencies that you might not want to expose to other places. Anyway, I don't want to really discuss what the whole drawbacks of that or the advantages of that actually is. I wanted to shed light on a different approach here, which would be the second solution, to kind of provide an automatic way to deal with these kind of ambiguities. That's something that's not actually done in C++, but there's other languages out there that offer you the comfort of resolving this ambiguity in an automatic way. And the basic idea on all that is to not only linearize the object layout in some way that is kind of in a sequence, but also the inheritance graph in a way that it's not a tree or a graph anymore, but instead just a simple sequence where you can always decide which of the members of that list actually has precedence over the other. So there's a few approaches to that, and all of them emanate from a few common things. So I'm going to first of all introduce them to you. So there's two basic principles involved when you specify your inheritance graph to the compiler. First of all, there's the basic inheritance relation that you establish between two classes, which is whenever you define that class A, or in this case class C, inherits from class A. And I'm introducing kind of a common notation for that. So in the case that C inherits from A, I would just write C and then in brackets A. And in case you would inherit from several parents, you would just continue with a comma-separated list from there. B, D, E. How many parents you want, you can just write them in there. And you would specify that there's an inheritance relation between each of the ones that you have in the list and your base class. So C would be your child class. So C would be inheriting from A, and C would be inheriting from B if the clause is like this. Then there's also another source for precedence in object-oriented systems, and that is the called the multiplicity relation. And this means that there's suggestions for also using the sequence in which you specify your parents as another source for inheritance. So if you inherit both from A and B, but you mention A first, then you would like to give precedence to A rather than B. So this would kind of be represented with another inheritance relation component, like A would then also have to inherit from B. So that's another source for that. I'm not saying that this is valid for all program languages, but there are some which treat multiplicity like that, and yeah, we'll see how that is used. So not all of these relations are valid contributions to the overall inheritance structure in all languages, but these are two roughly the sources for inheritance relations in general. What's also in common between most of the approaches that I've seen is that inheritance is a uniform mechanism in the sense that it treats all the methods and the fields the same way. So there's no way that you will find a certain inheritance inheritance graph or relation that's valid for just one method signature, and for the other method signature there will be some different inheritance graph. So it's just a uniform thing for all of the methods. It is treated the same way. Well, there's a few exceptions to that, in the sense that a few of the methods can be specified that they are resolved statically. Then, of course, the treatment which method is actually meant is a little bit different than for the dynamically resolved ones. But yeah, apart from that, in general, you would say that all of them are treated in the same way. In the literature, you will find also the name method resolution order for the thing that I'm calling the inheritance relation. So there's a few synonyms over there. So just if you read the background literature, this might also be called the method resolution order, MRO. And the other thing is that linearization is an approach that might not always yield a solution that really pleases you. There's decisions, there's a few degrees of freedom in there when you create these linearizations, and in some situations this might turn out to give quite odd results, and other approaches try to get rid of these odd results by just refusing to present a linearization for a few situations at all. These are also practical approaches that we'll cover, but you'll see them. So it's a best effort approach, and yeah, you might pick your poison when you design such a language yourself. So yeah, in general, what you need to come up with is some kind of linearization. And the so you need a kind of a topological search on your inheritance graph, and you can do so with different approaches. And one of the basic ones would be to just emanate from a depth first search through your graph, emanating from kind of the root node, and then just run through your whole system and see what the results look like, and see whether they are pleasing or not for our purposes. So let's start with that also. So we start with a depth first search. I've always written my kind of universal notation for the class definitions that yielded that graph over there, so that you can have an idea of what the specifications need to look like to create that. I've put the brown arrows in there to specify whenever I have come from a direct subclass relation. and these dotted orange ones whenever I come from a multiplicity relation. So this A being a subclass of B and C over here results in A being a subclass of B, which is this one, A being a subclass of C, which is this one, and then there's also the multiplicity B is in the sequence earlier than C, so this is what the orange one says, and it's giving us this orange error over here, and I've kind of indicated where the whole thing came from with this kind of with shaft over here. Okay, so that's for the just a visualization of the of these things. Yeah, what can we do if we do this depth first search? Well, for example, we can just put our numbers by leftmost preorder run of our depth first search, which means that I always take the leftmost branch first, and while descending through the graph, I'm gonna put my numbers in. So this will result in, well, what will it actually do? Well, start with a root. So this will be the first one. Then we go leftmost. This will be the second one. Depth first, so we will go over there. This will be the third one. And we go back up there, backtracking, and then go back over there and reach four. So I've always been going the brown edges and come up with A, B, W, C. So that's what we're going to see here. If we do so, well, we end up with this ABWC, which is clearly not something that's really pleasing to us because, oh, no, not like this, because we have WC in there, which is just directly violating the inheritance relation from over there. So that's something which is not pleasing. However, it turns out that the leftmost preorder, that first search, is something that was actually applied to multiple inheritance system, in this case Python. At least up to a certain version number, you had to deal with some kind of reversals in the inheritance relations when you had unsuitable definitions of your class structure. So even that seemed to be applied at some point. However, that's something that's clearly quite annoying to have in your inheritance structure. So people started thinking what you could do against that. And, well, the first idea was to just go on with the depth first search in leftmost preorder. And as soon as we reach something the second time, we remove the first occurrence of this of the thing from the chain. So what does that lead to in our thing? Well, we will have a linearization of A's object structure, starting with A, then we go to B, very nice, we go to W over here. We have to backtrack, we go to C, we'll right over there, and then we will reach W again. And this time, we had another occurrence of W in there, so we're gonna remove it. So that's duplicate cancellation. With that, we reach A, B, C, W, and the principle once is fixed once again. So that's what Python since version 2.2 then gives you. So that's how they solved that thing. However, using that still yields a few quite odd things. So let's have a look, for example, at the specification from down there. This leads to the inheritance graph that you see over there. So let's probably do one of these runs. So, oh no, not like this. So we start with A, then leftmost we go B, leftmost we go V, then backtrack and go on, we go W, backtrack, backtrack, go there, C, then leftmost. Well, here you see a kind of an odd structure with this curved arrow, but that's because I want to keep my my arrows the same way as I keep my multiplicity. So that's why I keep them like this, and you can see it over here. C, C's parents start with W, so that's why it's like this. So we go over to W. This will lead to removal of that. And then we go over to V. This will add that and remove this one. So that's nice. And as we have opposing multiplicity in our definition, that's one of the cases where you see that, well, it might be a nice idea to have a look at the multiplicity for linearizing your inheritance relation, but it's easy to specify something which contradicts each other with that. And the decision that Python does here is to ignore your inheritance advices via multiplicity at that point where it actually breaks and just do anything in, to ensure that at least the inheritance principles are still valid in there. So principle two is not not fulfillable in this situation. However, it looks a little bit weird to find BC in the expected multiplicity in there. So that's the one that we have already have specified. But then to find WV, where, well, B would be, people might consider B as a dominant object or the dominant specification over C because it's in the multiplicity of the common child. It is in front. However, C's multiplicity is actually making it into the general linearization. People found that a little bit irritating, and there's a long discussion on in the Python community about that, and or has been. Well, that's also passed at some point, and yeah, it's actually debatable what you can really do in that point. Another approach to the whole thing is trying to pay more respect to this multiplicity in detail, and was also considered to be a candidate for doing it better than just the duplicate eliminating depth first search on the leftmost pre-order run. And this case, it's still rightmost DFS as the basic thing, but now what we are going to do is we want to do the reverse post-order for the whole thing. And what does that mean? Well, that means that I put my my classes in the linearization when I ascend back from the leaves from my depth first search, and that looks like, well, like this. I start with A. I go rightmost, so I go C, I go H, I go W. W is the last thing that I'm going to do. So I'll write down W. And note that I put it down at the very end of the space because I actually have to reverse it afterwards, so I'm doing that already in my run here. So then I go back up, and while going back up, I put W over there. I reach the H, and H has no other child, so I go back up there, outputting H. So C now has another child, so I go back up, back down there. And this has another child, so I go back there and end up over here. So there's just another child that I've already put out, and there's no duplicate cancellation this time here, so I go back up here. Now C has all its children already visited, so I can put out C, and now I have to go back. B, yes please? No, there's no duplication elimination in this approach.
Okay, so why don't you go to W when you go to G?
This has to do with that we create the reverse thing, and for if we do so, then the first occurrence of a class that we meet will be the one that's actually fine to use, because we're going through the whole thing from bottom up then. As opposed to top down, so in this case we will visit the last occurrence of a class anyway as for yeah.
Okay, so you go to G, you go to W, you notice that it's already in there. You ignore it. You go back to G, and then.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I've missed, I think, is E. That's what you want. Yeah. Good. Yeah, but. Yeah, I would go down to B, but I see that B is already visited and ignore it in this case. Mm. So, yeah, I have to go to C, then I have to go over to B. B has still children, so I go to D. G is already visited, so I can go to D, and I have to put out F, B, A. And turns out that's... quite nice, but still there's a few situations where when you mix around your declarations of your multiplicity that you might still confuse that algorithm. And an example for that is something that you will see here, and the problematic thing here is that, well, we don't have to go through all that in detail, but I can show you where it actually breaks. We have a rightmost run through the whole thing, so we come through this here, and at some point we will have F preceding G, and later on we will discover that there's a multiplicity relation over here that reverts this thing. So this is something that will break our feeling for how the linearization should actually be, or well, at least a few people's thing. So what they implemented to get it right was to do a kind of, another approach, which is the refined version of the whole thing, which would, as soon as it discovers that there's a multiplicity relation which is broken in there, so this would be in this case this one here, this is violated by this GF over here. And as soon as the system realizes that this is violated, it would introduce a new inheritance relation at the place where it discovered that the violation was done. So it would kind of promote the multiplicity relation to be new inheritance relation, and rerun the whole thing, and do so until the system either stabilizes or is proven to be not satisfiable for, well, one unique, all-fulfilling linearization. And well, in this case, everything turns out to be fine as soon as we introduce the new inheritance relation over there. it actually helps. So there are situations where that actually works, but there's also situations where we just run into a conflict on the inheritance relations when we gradually insert new ones. And in these cases, the system would give up and tell us, go figure out a new inheritance relation yourself. Yes, please. Where it actually breaks? Well, I think you would just have to start from the system where you have a direct inheritance relation between G and F, where F then would be the superclass. So if you at some point violate the inheritance relations in your clauses or in the transitive closure of your multiplicities, then you would run in that kind of error.
You can't actually ever inherit from something that you have the orange arrow with, right? Because the orange arrow is on.
Yeah, or even the other way around, you should not specify your multiplicity in a way that it goes against the inheritance relation. That's what kind of the intuitive way of saying would be. Yeah, but that of course that leads to a conflict in some way. If you want, if you have at some point specified your inheritance in that way, and at the other point you say, yeah, but from a multiplicity point of view, I would like to have the other way. So yeah, that will in the end lead up with. But at least that approach actually yields an error then, and say, well, you have. You have two conflicting plans of what you want to do, and please think once again. Well, I'm not an actual Lisp expert, but at least literature told me that that would be the way that the CLOS system at least offers to perform the linearization in the default way. Lisp experts in the audience at that point normally say, well, you can configure it to be something different then. Yeah, but at least there, that is the approach that, or that is the language where you can find an implementation of that approach. So, yeah. That's where it all stems from, and that acted as kind of a source in this discussion of what to do for linearization at several for several languages. So there's still one thing for automatic linearization that I want to show you, and that is actually another principle. Next to multiplicity and just normal inheritance, which would be monotonicity, which would say that another feature that we haven't talked about so far, but as systems that had automatic linearization grew more mature, people realized that that would be something desirable. And what monotonicity is about is that it means that when at some point you have linearization generated for a composed class like this very difficult one over here, then you would like for the linearization of that, whenever you have in there given the precedence to one class over the other, that for all the subclasses of this class and their linearizations, that all these linearizations give the same precedence to the others. So this means that if you a desirable feature of a linearization algorithm would be that if you linearize a large a deep down child in a multiple inheritance system like this A, then and then take another class, which is in at some point a subclass of the a parent of the larger one. That and what you want is that all the linearization decisions that were taken while performing the linearization in this case of the green box would also be results of the linearization of the blue box in this case. So that why is that so nice as a property? Well, this means that when you start from your class structure on a very basic way with just a few composed classes and increase the set of these composed classes one by one, even more and more and more, that you will never get the situation that by introducing another completely different and so far not covered class that inherits from the things that you have specified before, you will get different linearizations of its parents than you were used to when you started in the beginning. So that's something, if you have growing systems, you're pretty interested in something like that. So that this won't break things that you have you had as intuition how the linearization works beforehand. And yeah, so monotonicity is something that you want for growing systems. And turns out that the things that we have looked at beforehand don't really guarantee monotonicity. For example, the refined, this large word. Yeah, that was the end. let's try to find the page where I left off. Yeah, that's at least a little bit close. Okay, so let's have a look at the situation in the refined reverse post order rightmost depth first search, and turns out that if we let it run on the example to the right and let it compute a linearization for class A, so for this thing, turns out that we get this linearization, which would say that at some point F is a child class of G. But now let's have a look at what the linearization of C actually says. So it's this one here. This will yield this one, and from that we can say that, well, G must be the subclass of F. So with that we have contrary statements about which of the classes actually have precedence over the other. So our refined, reversed, and so on approach is probably one that does not fulfill monotonicity. Well, we have proven by example here. So what should we do now if we actually want something that has monotonicity? Well, we'll have to live with the with the situation that in some cases the compiler will now just refuse to translate my code because I have some a specification that actually will create something that doesn't that makes it impossible to create a monotone environment. But if we're happy with that, then we can do our method resolution with a thing that is called the C3 linearization. which is a pretty modern thing here. And the idea here is to compose linearizations from former linearizations of parents classes. So what do I need for something like that? Well, I need kind of the leaves for my inheritance graphs, which, well, for Java example, is the object thing. In this case, I would say the linearization of these leaves things are just the classes themselves. So these are the very basic components there. So if a class doesn't have any parents, its linearization is just itself. For each other situation, when a class C has actually a few parents B1 to BN, then if I want to compute the linearization for C, then what I do is C will always come first in my linearization. The dots are just kind of list constructors in this context here. I have to compute my linearization then out of several components. The linearizations of all my parents, for example. And then I somehow need to add the multiplicity in some way into the whole linearization. So the multiplicity, that's something that was defined with this sequence, and it goes into the computation of the larger linearization as another component for precedence, and that's the last list that we're going to see here. So this is a composed expression here. You've seen that it has linearizations of the parents, which are each of them is just a list. And it also has a multiplicity also as a list in there. And now it's somehow merged into each other with this merge operator. So what is that merge operator defined as? Well, we'll see over here. So this merge is acting like this. So it has several lists as parameters. So that's what I kind of write here with this small subscript I. So these are the several linearization lists that we got as parameters. So L of B1 is L1 here, L of Bn is Ln, and this thing is Ln plus 1. Well, these are the lists here, and they are combined in a certain way. Well, what you do is you recursively take... or merge smaller lists and take out a certain component from all of these lists and put it in front of the resulting thing. And what is it that you take out from all the parameter lists? Well, you try to find you go through all the lists that you put there as a parameter and take the head from each of these lists and try out whether or check whether this thing that you have, this head that you now are looking at, occurs somewhere in the tail of each of the other lists. And in case that it's not element of the tail of each of the other lists, then you've found your the candidate for putting in front of the merged thing. And if you several of these candidates, you take the one from the lists up front, or the one that comes from the foremost position in the parameters list. So at that point, you just need to have some valid way to decide which of them has to be taken. So in this case, we just have our minimum operator here is the standard thing to do. Okay, and you go on to do so with merging all the remaining lists and of course, also the list that you've taken the head from, and remove this your candidate from all of them, so you get smaller lists each time that you do one of these merging steps. You do so well. I have not specified here what will actually be done if there is no list left, but well, you do so until all the lists are empty, and then you terminate. Or in case that you can't find any head that when all the heads are actually occurring in some of the lists in the tail, then you will say, well, this is a situation where we cannot find a linearization, and you will just bail out saying fail. And these are the situations where we cannot construct a linearization because there's multiplicity or inheritance yielding some kind of ambiguity. So let's do an example run of that. Once again, we start from the graph that we've seen so many times now. So the first ones are the basic ones that are pretty simple. F and G don't have any parents. These are the leaves of our inheritance graph. And for that, we can just take the linearization of G as being G itself, same as the linearization of F is just F itself. So these are the simple ones. Now, let's continue with linearization for E. What's that? Well, I have to construct this merging operator over all its parents, and E is, well, E just have one just has one parent, and it's F, and for these ones also pretty simple. You put the E in front and then have to merge just F, so this will just end up in being F, so the whole thing is EF. Same goes for D. No. D is actually just having one parent, so this will be D, and in this case, G. So these were also pretty simple. So let's come to a more advanced one. Now let's look at B, which has two parents, and yeah, B has to be composed to the merge of the linearization of F and the linearization of G, as well as I have to somehow respect the multiplicity, so I put FG, the list of those, over here as the third component, and yeah, I continue in the next line. It's the same as B merged with LF is just F. LG is, well, G, and the list FG. And now, that's the first time that I now really have to work a little bit. I have to perform this merging here, and yeah, for that, what do I need to do? I need to find a candidate for the head of my list, and I start with a minimal index because, well, that's what I have as a differentiation between the lists anyway, so I start up front with F and have to check whether F is a member of a tail of any of the other lists. So F is not a member of G at all. It is a member of the list FG, but it's the head of FG, so I'm completely fine with that. So I can take F as the new head and then just have the empty list over here, G. I don't have to take F from G because it's not a member of that. And here, F was a member of that list, but now that I have chosen that as the head, I can just write G over there and go on. Well, I should have put the merge over there, so I lost that. So let's do B F, and in this case, well, epsilon has just no head, so I just remove that. G would be the next candidate. Let's check G, and well, it's not a member of the tail of that, so B of G is the right thing. Yes, please?
If there's just one single character, there
it's counted as the head.
Yeah, it's counted as the
head. Yeah. But valid question. So, yeah, okay, I do all the steps in there already. So, yeah, BFG. Good. So the next thing, C is now even more complicated because it involves D, which itself is like this, and E, which is, so it's longer lists now, and this ends up in this thing over here. So C goes in front as always, and then we have the list for D, E, and D, E from the multiplicity, and yeah, this will turn out to be this one, and now let's try to choose. So first one would be D. D only occurs here, but that's fine. That's just another head. So we take this one out and have C. D is our thing. So now next thing would be we have to find another head. So let's try G. Well, G turns out not to be in there, so let's take it over here. It's never somewhere there, so that's fine. So next thing would be E. Well, E is now the new head of the last list, so that's also fine. So that would be the linearization. Good, just the principles from before. So, so far everything went fine, but as we know from the introduction to the C3 linearization, the whole graph has a thing that actually is not monotone in there, and we'll probably hit that with our last linearization now. So that would be what I have to do for linearization of A. So that's the linearization of B inlined. That's the linearization of C, and that's the multiplicity. So let's try it out. And yeah, we have A to start from. Then to check for B. Is B a valid candidate? Well, B is just occurring over here, so that's fine. Let's remove it from here and from here. Go on with F. Is F a valid candidate? No, it's not, because it's occurring here, so we have to skip that and go over to G. Is G a valid candidate? Well, it's also occurring over there, so it's not. So we can take the... Mistake. Shouldn't have continued with G because it's not a head. Sorry. I was too quick, so nobody noticed anyway. Yeah, it's just
time. If we were to continue with G, you said it was not a valid candidate.
Yeah, because it's in the...
So the tail is everything apart from the first element.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the functional thing that you have in OCaml or in Haskell with a head and tail. Yeah. Okay, so you will continue with the C. And C, well, it's not here in the tail, and this is just a singleton list here and has no tail, so we can take C and remove it. Well, the situation for F has not changed now, so we can go over to this one. And let's check for D. Well, D is nowhere else to be found, so let's take it and remove it. Now, the situation for F once again has not changed. Now we have G. G is occurring here once again, so we also cannot take this. So we now have to, C is also has been deleted from that thing, so we don't have a list here anymore. So at that point, we can now neither take F as the next element in our linearization, and we also cannot take G because it's in the other linearization already in another precedence. And well, that's the point where the whole system just fails, and it even can give you the two classes that are involved, which are actually violating your inheritance thing. So the notable things over here is as long as as long as you didn't add this last component which put the whole system in an inconsistent state, you can the system comes up with a valid linearization. Only as soon as you add the latest child, which then breaks everything, you get a failed linearization attempt here. And yeah, apart from that, as long as the linearization doesn't fail, you always get this comfortable situation of having a monotone linearization of your system, which I think is quite fine. And it turns out that a lot of people really like these properties, and the C3 linearization is something which is, meanwhile, quite widely used out there. And as linearizations are things that are quite quite complicated, and linearization algorithms are things that are more of a best effort strategy, and people will always argue which of the approaches will always be the best. People tended to rely on a few successive approaches to the whole thing, and C3 linearization turned out to be one of the most successful linearizations out there. So yeah, that's what you find in a lot of languages now. So if you, for example, look at Dylan or Python or Perl 6, you will find this C3 linearization in there. Is it?
About the way you resolve this. When you have your multiplicity B, C, you remove your B list because your F was used in the end to the C list. So you were never considering it again. But couldn't it be that the issue F had being mentioned later in C could have been resolved?
Yeah, but I think you would have left the way that you choose the list from which to take the head with that in that way, and I think that's something that would swap once in a while you're generating more and more of these classes, and this way you. I'm not sure whether you can find something that really looks nice with that. Probably I also misunderstood you at some point. You meant somewhere in step of linearization of LA in this case. So can you say stop for which step? So probably. That's already this one here.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
At that point, you say your candidates from B, for that list you're not going to consider anymore. You scrapped it out.
I have to take respect to F is in the linearization in front of G, so I cannot continue with G in this case because it would violate some other linearization. But I can, of course, consider G from the point of view that it is over here. So that's what I'm doing for sure. But in this case, I will realize that although G is head here, it's also in the tail here. So I cannot take it.
Okay, now imagine that your first list
We can have something in the middle, for example, if that helps.
This is a two-way conflict because they just swapped the position. What if your F is blocked because it's mentioned in the second list, but G is. never mentioned in the first list. So at the point
when it is never mentioned in the first list, it would be fine as a head. If it's not here, but instead an H, for example, then I could just take the G.
No, but
G. But G.
Yeah, but G you weren't considering because G was already a tail, because F you cannot use.
Yeah, but if it's not a tail, I can use it. Unless if... Yeah, and F is the only head.
Yes, so you cannot check G even, because G is a tail, so you don't care. So you continue, mm-hmm. and you just say, this list I'm not going to use it because it's blocked, because F is used somewhere else.
Yes.
But if G wasn't there, at some point you could have, in the second list,
yeah.
F.
Yeah, that's what I have to do.
First list, perfectly viable again, but you already said I'm not going to consider that list.
So probably there was a misunderstanding here, but in fact the F, okay, I skipped this because F, it's head blocked, so to say, the first list. But the second one now is, at least up to now, it's not head blocked, but then I check that there's G over here, and my condition for G to go in front is that it doesn't, that it's never occurring in the tail somewhere, but it is. So I cannot take the G either.
Yeah, it was about my question was more about resolution. You were scrapping lists out of the multiplicity order because one was blocked. You just said this B list, I'm going to scrap it because it is blocked. But it could be that later it becomes unblocked. No?
Yeah. Well, if I succeed in removing all of these by some other heads, then it might become unblocked again. Yeah.
So you actually don't scrap your list out of
the No. That was just for that round. Sorry. Yeah. So it's not a permanent permanently throwing away. It's just not considering for this round. Okay, and it's just also it's only just my implementation of what the formula over here gives you. So, yeah, you don't throw it away. You just consider the first occurrence of a head that is never used as a tail somewhere. Okay. Good. So as time is already ticking. Not gonna talk too much about that. You can read that from there. The only thing that I want to mention is the things that are influenced in the choice whether you want to have explicit qualification or linearization in order to deal with multiple inheritance is one thing. For example, the super reference. So that's something. For super to be meaningful, you need to have one unique predecessor, one unique parent. So that's something that you only get if you have some either a single inheritance or some way of linearization. Otherwise, super is not meaningful because it can go to both sides. So whenever you find a language where you have super without anything else as a valid expression somewhere, then you'll know that you will have either a single inheritance or some way of linearization going on. Then, so for linearization, you don't have to do any switching, any explicit naming. However, it might introduce some awkward or unexpected behavior in there. And we have seen languages for which there was linearization implemented, and also it serves as something which might become handy when you start programming with mixins, because for that you need some way of uniquely saying this is my parent. So for that it's actually useful. So that was a short excursion on how to handle method resolution in multiple inheritance. Yes.
If I understand correctly, it's all about whether this algorithm that we
Yeah, that's always a problem of, yeah, you as language designer are confronted with what the users actually expect from your language. And
would it not be easier for the program just to write the linearization itself? Because I mean, if I have such a
inheritance
structure, then it's not really a problem to write one line, and then I'm really sure that the language is going to do what I expect.
Yeah, systems tend to be in this modular way where you only specify upgrades to already existing things. So this is something that kind of prohibits you from specifying once on a central place in your system how your linearization should look like, and kind of gives you a model where you only specify deltas to already existing things. And this is the way. This is why you have these kind of partial specifications, these local specifications of how inheritance should look like, and people like to have this way of just specifying extensions to things that have already been there, and not to bother with the whole system, but just with at one point local changes that you want to do. And there's a lot of people who hate to access different files if they want to just insert one thing.
But the program can still always say, I want the method from this class.
Yeah, but at some point you need to find the place in the global linearization where to put your class in. That would be what you would need to do if you want to if you specify your linearization yourself. Apart from that, if you have single inherit...
Does anyone actually use it because it seems like too much
work? Well, you mean linearization or specifying a linearization as explicit list?
Multiple
inheritance. Well, you could just ask the audience. Does anyone use multiple inheritance? Yeah, the linearization is...
Very specific classes, I mean, it's specific classes that are so big.
Yeah, but you don't do it on purpose. It's like, okay, I'm writing a doc, it's inheriting from bird, it's inheriting from something else. You never pay attention to just bird, duck is a bird.
Okay,
and you're not thinking about bird might have feathers and like the dinosaur has feathers or whatever else like your library might have.
Okay, so it's basically an error that happens.
Well, anyway, that was just when we were introducing multiple inheritance at all. Now let's have a look at one of the, or more on the technical details of what we have to do when we want to implement multiple inheritance. And what we have not looked at right now is virtual methods and multiple inheritance. And now things become messy once again. So, virtual tables for multiple inheritance turns out to be that with virtual methods you cannot use plain virtual tables that you had before. Why is that? Well, the things that we have seen before we talked about linearization was that there's this concept of the the methods needing to always address the fields that they have at a kind of known place. So we were talking about that they have always have to be indexed from the beginning of the object representation in some place. So now that we introduce multiple inheritance, we have learned that the position of these fields are now not fixed anymore, but they might be at some they might be shifted some way depending on where the object representation is based in the child class. example was this object representation for B, which landed somewhere in the middle of our C representation. And the whole system gets even more confusing if you add multiple inheritance, because then you the thing is that although you have at some point specified a method for a parent class, like for example the F over here, was it even G? That's well, I think the F is in this case the one that I'm wanting to talk about. So we have specified them in the parent classes, and at some point also in the child classes, and we assume that there's always another implementation that is added with an external definition, but I'm not really too keen to look into the actual implementation here. I'm just talking about how the layout for the virtual method should be. Well, in any way, we said that for calling these the methods that have been that have been defined somewhere in the parents, we need to provide pointers to the particular type that these methods belong to. So, for example, if you want to call the F in the with a object representation of C, but if we access the whole thing over a pointer to B, then we need to, from our calling conventions, we need to provide a pointer to class B to the whole thing. However, as we have virtual method calls involved in the whole thing, if we overwrite this thing in class C, then what is actually expected to be called is the implementation of that that comes from class C. And however, the pointer to the receiver, this pointer, is from the calling convention perspective still needs to be pointing to B. So if we in the overwritten function F, we want to access, for example, the offset C, the offset for the field C, we have only the implementation that comes from over here, which expects the C to reside over here, which is somewhere deep down in the object representation for C. However, this offset over here is only valid when we have a look at the complete representation of C. If we give the as a receiver pointer for a method call instead of the address that points to the beginning over here, but instead give it the pointer that points to the beginning of B, we have a mismatch here, because if we add the offset that would have been added to the beginning of the complete representation to here, we will end up somewhere out of our known memory. And yeah, that's why I cannot, when I have multiple inheritance and virtual tables, I cannot just realize the whole system with only one implementation of my overwritten methods. But instead, I need to provide something that accounts for situations where this pointer is not pointing to where I actually expect it to be. The solution for that is to not use one virtual table where there's only one possibility of what my entry in the virtual table would be, but to instead go over to use multiple virtual tables for parents in my multiple inheritance environment, like you see here. For this example, we have now not a unique virtual table for all purposes of the composed object C, but kind of two parts of the virtual tables which collaborate in order to make all of our features like virtual method resolving and casting still working. So there's this part over here and this part over here, both of them separated in my diagrams with just the dotted line. And in the object representation, we now also have several pointers to the virtual table. Here, the one that is over here is pointing to the first part of the virtual table, like this. And then for my inner parent, this B, I have another virtual table pointer, which points to the other fragment of the virtual table. This is because as soon as I start casting around, I will at some point do an address manipulation on the object representation, where I will add the offset where my actual inner parent is found to my object's beginning. And then if I want to do method resolution, I will still expect the first field that I access from this now modified pointer to be a pointer to the virtual table. So that's why I have now two entries for the virtual table pointer. And because, as I told you before, I have to still give the possibility to adjust this pointer back to a version that can be used by overwritten methods, like, for example, this F. I'm quite happy with having two different virtual table pointers, because now in the first virtual table, where I come to when I access it from A or C, I will be able to just use the plain F method. And in the case where I prematurely casted my object down to some to the pointer to B, and thus had it point to here, I will use a different implementation of F, which I call now F in the context of being casted to B. And this thing is just acting as a kind of prefix to the ordinary function f, and this will readjust its first parameter from pointing from here back to the original start of the object, so that my overwritten method, this one here, Christ's sake, so that the implementation that actually has to be called the implementation of F in the C class actually finds a pointer to the representation of the whole thing, which would need to be pointing to the start here. So I've put another slide on there to illustrate what would happen over here. So these are the different ways to call the method F. F is overwritten in class C, so it is one implementation that emanates from the fact that this pointer would need to point to an representation of type C. So there's two ways to access that. The one is this way, where you create a C and store it in a pointer to class C. In this case, you don't need to do anything because the C pointer hasn't been casted in any way. It has been just taken as it came from the constructor, so I can just call F without any prerequisites, and I can still address anything that I find by just adding it as an offset to the pointer to C, and I'm fine in that case. However, if it turns out that at some point I create a C and cast it implicitly or explicitly to one of the parents, then I have two choices. Either I cast it to A. In this case, nothing happens because it's residing at the same point as C has, and I don't need to do any casting. But if I cast it to the inner parent, which is this B, then I completely forget about that my object representation had something to do with C, and I try to just call F in a very dumb way, meaning that F will expect to get a pointer to this of type B. So I need in the intermediate representation, or in the end in the assembler, I need to cast to B, because that's what my convention for casting to B will have to do. So I will take the B thing. However, the F implementation is the one that was specified for objects of representation for class C in mind. And they expect actually to have a pointer to C over there. So in this case, just calling the plain F here will result in something which we don't know how it ends. So we need the pointer to point to C once again. And in order to do so, we introduce an intermediate function, which is called func. And I tried to visualize that with this B thing. And the role of the func is to readjust the pointer to the original value. And you see what it does over here. And as we are already almost out of time, I will try to lead your eyes to the relevant part, which is over here. So what will be done is that this pointer that's given to it, which is of type B pointer, will be adjusted back up to the beginning of the pointer. And this will be considered to be then a pointer to class C, and then the actual call to method F will happen now with the adjusted pointer to this. So that's what the func is all about. So for that, we need to insert this thing in the virtual table of the inner parents part. And so for B, for the B and C V table, the entry which is associated with the function fint is instead the func underscore f in our case here. And what it will do, it will call the original f and perform the adjustment of this pointer. Okay, so back to that. Now you know what this actually should mean. This is the func that will in the end also call F, but beforehand will adjust this pointer at some point. A few words to the general layout of the virtual table, because it is not only function calls anymore, but instead what we'll find there is a part where there's function pointers, which is this one here. And any virtual table pointer that you find in object representation will always point to the first occurrence of a function pointer in the virtual table. Why is that? Well, I say that is so because there's now also other components in the virtual table stored, which I have lied about in the past. And I said that they wouldn't be there, but instead they indeed are. So there's other pointers there. For example, this pointer to the runtime type information object, which we ignore for our purposes. And another one, which is this is indexed with -2 to the virtual table pointer. And what you find here is the offset of the object part that you're coming from via the virtual table pointer to the actual top of your current object. So looking back to the representation, how it looks like, if you come to the virtual table from here and go through the virtual pointer over here, you will end up here. And if you index back two fields, you will end up with this one. And this will tell you, well, the beginning of your enclosing object is actually an offset of 0 away from your current object pointer. Well, that's still here, so everything's fine for that. If you come through a different path over here and through this virtual table pointer here, you will end up here. You index back two fields and end up here, which will tell you that the beginning of your object representation is now delta b away from your current object pointer, which will mean that you will have to go up delta b to reach your original thing. This is used in case you need to cast back down to your actual object C. And yeah. Anyway, that's just if you're confused or wondering what that thing actually means. This is the offset to the top of the enclosing object representation, starting from your current object representation. So now that we have 4 o'clock, I think we will have to interrupt and continue next time. So thank you for your coming here, and see you again tomorrow or next week, depending on what you like to do.